Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Revolution Radio. I'm going to bring our guests on right away and do a little bit of an introduction. Let me see. Commander Kirshner? Commander Kirshner, hopefully my computer is going to work this evening. Are you there? Commander Kirshner?
Hello?
Hello, is that Commander Kirshner?
This is Commander Kirshner.
Good evening. Good evening, Dr. Kate. And Attorney Apuzzo, is that you?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening, Dr. Kate. Hello, Commander.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. Welcome. Welcome. I think this is, just wonderful that you're here. You are my favorite guests. And good evening, everyone here. If you wouldn't mind, gentlemen, I'd like to do just a brief introduction because I think this is a pivotal point that we are at in your more than 2-year struggle to bring this case to fruition. And I'd like to start with a thank you very much for all of your work. Secondly, to our guest, welcome. And I'd just like to ask you all, like right now and through the whole show and once we're done, is to really offer your prayers that the Supreme Court takes this case because it is absolutely critical. Now, remember, John Kennedy, I've been doing this for about a year, said that those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. We are at that point, folks, in so many ways. In the one-plus year of this case with Commander Kirshner, we have learned a lot. Those who know the eligibility issue know that this case has gone all the way, gone through all the hoops, fearless, without stumbling. And being on the steps of the Supreme Court, you have to have a ripe case. You have to gone through all the appeals, no bypassing any steps at all. So this is a real challenge to the court, and it's a real testing point for us, for all of us, to see how far the corruption has gone and where we are. Now, the attack on America, as you know, has been really fundamental. And what could be more fundamental than to attack our individual liberties? Protected. We are protected from messing with those in the Constitution. The whole issue of standing that has plagued all of the cases so forth, we have that standing. It's guaranteed. It's protecting our liberty interest. That's what the Constitution does. So I'd like to just roll through a couple things, gentlemen, and then just move from there, if you don't mind. I can be windy, but I'll try to be short. What I have learned from looking at the petition for writ of certiorari and all of your work, Mario, and please feel free to correct me as we go through this conversation, but we as individuals, we the people, decided what our form of government was that would best protect our liberty interests and keep us safe and protect our safety. We also then specified and had the right to specify the qualifications of certain positions. In other words, who would be the president? Not just an American citizen, not just a citizen, had to be a natural-born citizen. That is who we felt and we feel who would best protect our liberty interests. It's not a personality contest, and it's not about equal opportunity. It is really about the specifics of that position. Words, requirements for a meaning, what did it mean? What do those words mean? Commander Kirshner has gone, you should look on the website there, to look at what those words mean in the Constitution and so forth. So what we have right now is that, of course, Obama did not comply with providing his qualifications. Congress failed to ensure that, and as a result, we the people are not protected. I don't know about you, but I don't feel as protected as an American citizen from a non-NBC, by a non-NBC, as I would with a natural-born citizen. So the essence of the Kirshner case is really, in my view, the Constitution. And if the court refuses to hear this, they have struck at the heart of our rights. This is really quite serious, and action will have to ensue. So tonight, we're welcome Commander Kirshner and Attorney Apuzzo with great regard. I have a few questions, just basically, again, that issue of standing is something that people don't understand. I'd like you to comment on what you found with Daniel Webster's work, an overview, what you think about that CRS memo, which, in fact, Attorney Apuzzo uncovered through the help of people who are working with him. And, of course, then what are the possibilities? Did they take the case or not? For the listeners, thank you all for listening to me. But for the first hour or so, we'll have the commander and Attorney Apuzzo really talk about what they'd like to. And then we will take a five-minute break. I'm alone this evening managing the call, so I will then want to screen calls. And then I'd like to save the last hour or so for questions and answers if that works. And, of course, those questions need to be on point with the case and so forth. But anyway, all that having said, welcome. Thank you for listening.
Glad to be here.
Great.
Dr. Kate, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I was just wanted to say for those in your listening audience that the reason a natural-born citizen is in there to protect our rights is because only a natural-born citizen is a person born with no divided loyalties. He's born with sole allegiance to the United States and no other country at birth. And that can only be achieved by being born in the United States of two American citizens. And that's why a natural-born citizen was that term was selected, so that nobody with any foreign influence at birth could ever get command of our military, which is the second responsibility of the being president is commander-in-chief. And just if anybody out there doesn't realize that, that's what's embodied in the term natural-born citizen, that you are born with allegiance to only one country by the laws of nature and nature's God. No other country in the world can claim you.
And from that regard, in the petition for writ, of course, you said the main reason, one of the main reasons the court needs to take the case is because that requirement is a national security requirement for our country.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, Dr. Kate, I'd like to add that you did say something that was very profound about the Kirchner case, and you said it's about the Constitution. You know, really the essence of it, and that's absolutely correct because basically, you know, if we go back to the Revolution, you know, why did we have a revolution? Because we wanted change. Well, why do we want change? Because we wanted to change our happiness, so to speak. You know, we weren't happy with that condition, so we figured, well, we're going to have a revolution, and we're going to change our life, and we're going to make our lives happy. And then we realized, well, you know, we can't just do it by ourselves. We need a government to do that. And that's where the protection comes in. So we give our freedoms, a part of it, whatever we give it to the government, and we say, okay, now you protect us. And
we give them our allegiance. That's what we're giving up. We give up our allegiance and promise our allegiance to the government in return for that protection.
Yeah. We say, yo, we'll follow you. We'll do what you say we have to do. Of course, that includes, you know, going to war. If we have a war, we have to, you know, take the gun and go to battle. So that's the allegiance that the commander is speaking about. But the point is that the whole purpose of government is to protect the people. But it has to do it in a limited sense. You know, don't get in the way of the people. You know, let the people thrive and let them be happy and let them be industrious and creative and prosper.
Protect their people and the unalienable rights that they fought for in a revolution. Protect those rights, too.
Right, right. And the Constitution tells us what those rights are, life, liberty, property. And liberty really has a lot of different components to it. And so does life. You know, safety, security, tranquility, it's all part of it. So what are we saying here? We're saying, well, you know, we give a certain job to the president. Now, I said we the people. Again, you know, we said, okay, look, you know, we need certain people in government to do this. So the president is one of them. Again, he's only a part of the government. Now, the whole government is supposed to protect us. The executive has a certain power. Protect, that's the purpose. And the founding father said, well, that's a powerful position, singular, all-powerful. We want to make sure that that person has the values and the mindset to preserve what we've created and to protect and defend the nation, its people, and the Constitution. And they figured that a natural-born citizen would be the best person to do that because you're born into a family, and the family is a natural unit. That's where you learn from. You know, that's where you're cultured from. You learn your language, your values, and so on and so forth. And the parents have a great deal of impact on how a child is raised. And that, you know, the family gives you those values. So that's where the natural born citizen comes in, because it's through the children of the citizens, of the original citizens, it's only through them that the new nation will be preserved and prosper in the future. So, and again, that only applies to the president. they were more lenient with the other branches of government because it's not a singular and all powerful. You know, they're collegial bodies. So they, again, you know, the House of Representatives, the Senate, the courts. They don't have to be natural born citizens.
Command of the military is a key power that the president has, and that's the danger that he would not act and use the military properly, either offensively or defensively, to protect America at a key time if he has a foreign father, for example.
Yes, Dr. Kate.
So that's why John Jay asked George Washington to put it in there.
Excellent. Thank you for that description, because that's why this is about, you know, the attack on our country has been really amazing. And so that's why this is about the Constitution. Thank you for supporting that.
And the standing issue is being problematic in the courts, because the Constitution is there to protect the individual rights of every citizen, not just the majority. And each and every citizen has an inalienable right, I believe, under the Ninth Amendment, to protect the rights that we got from God and what we earned through the Revolution, and we created the social contract, the Constitution, to give us the protection to protect those rights for perpetuity. And Obama's usurping that by not living up to the contract. He's not a natural-born citizen.
So this is an issue of so much importance to my readers and also our listeners, is the standing issue. And Mario was, I believe, also laying the basis of that within the Constitution. And I'd like you to go through that and tell us how you think, what happened. Did they invent too much of a standing issue? You know, was it really a straw man case, as I put out in my article on standing in the Constitution, or you know, was it really people just ducking out, notwithstanding that we knew there were going to be, you know, rejections based on standing? But what happened if the rights seemed to be so clear as they were laid out there? How did we get here? And then your take on what happens if they do or do not take this case. So free flow, gentlemen.
Well, first of all, our standing argument, okay, which again I presented to the Supreme Court, and I've confirmed what I've argued through my essay on Daniel Webster, which you know, I published on my blog. It was an incredible find when I saw that, because he basically says exactly what I said in the district court, in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and also in the petition to the Supreme Court, that again, you know, it's going back to what we were just saying about protection, that an individual has these rights, and the president is supposed to be a natural born citizen. He's supposed to protect you with respect to those rights. If he's not a natural born citizen, you cannot put your faith in him or her. You know, you cannot give your consent to that person exerting this executive power over you. Again, we didn't make that up. The Founding Fathers said that. They made the requirement. We didn't do that. This is not a figment of Commander Kirchner's imagination or my other client's imagination. You know, we're just applying the policy, the rule, the fundamental principle that was established by the Founding Fathers. You know, it was based on their experience. Again, we have to think about the context of revolution, which is what they went through. They knew what allegiance meant. They knew where you could have your neighbor decide to go with the British, and then the next-door neighbor to that one go with the Americans. I mean, and it was life or death based on your allegiance. So they knew what allegiance meant. They knew what the divided loyalties meant. They knew how important it was, and they were so strict on it. They had these oaths that they required. They didn't trust anybody. They said, look, you know, you got to give us an oath, or else we don't know who you are. We can't trust you. So they lived through the concept of allegiance, and that's why they really focused on that. So I made these arguments to the court. Neither lower court addressed my arguments, neither of them. None of them spoke about protection, which is what my argument is. They simply said that it was a general grievance. They call it a grievance. Okay, this is not a grievance. No, this is something that's written in the Constitution as an
right.
element of protection. It's not a grievance. You know, but they soft pedal it or whitewash it, whatever you want to call it, and don't address it. Like for example, you know, they focus on Commander Kirchner's oath of office, for example, okay, and they say, well, you know, what are the chances that he's going to be called back to the military? That you know that there's no chance there. So they try to make like that's our argument, which is really not our argument, okay. So again, I hope that the Supreme Court sees that our argument for standing was never addressed. I hope that they do address it. And again, you know, we have to go from there. And standing is really a case-by-case decision that's made by the courts. You know, if they want to find standing in a difficult case, they can find it. All you got to do is just say the right words. I mean, that's one problem that we have with the law, is that a judge can actually make, you know, a decision and then write the opinion to support the decision, okay? And that decision will look, it'll look perfect. It'll look perfect. It'll look like the court actually went through a process of looking for the right answer and then came up with the answer, okay? And you have no idea that they really, you know, they had the answer first and then wrote the opinion, you know, to support it. So we're at the mercy of the intellectual honesty, the morality of a judge. You know, when he makes a decision, when she makes a decision, we're at their mercy. You know, we give our faith to them, and we hope that they, when they do render a decision, they do it, you know, with their heart and with their soul and with their morals, that it's something that is based on, you know, you're looking for the truth, you're looking for the answer. Here's the facts, here's the evidence, and here's the law. You know, you're hoping that it's not something where they decided ahead of time and then look to make the decision. But standing is like that. You know, you can write any opinion you want on standing, and you'll come out with an answer that you want. So that we're at the mercy of the court when it comes to standing. I don't think it's well defined enough where you can actually say, oh, how can that be? I mean, there are some extreme examples. For example, like, you know, my next door neighbor broke their arm. You know, and then, you know, I can't sue because it's not my broken arm. You know, I mean, that's the ridiculous.
Mario,
you know,
can I just ask you to explain to the listening audience, the Constitution just says you have to show a case and controversy, right? All these
yes.
other rules, the court invented later to be able to filter out what case they want to take or not. But the Constitution, maybe you can just cite it. All it says in Article 3, there must be what? A case and controversy.
Yes, yeah, case or controversy. Either
or controversy.
One.
Well, we certainly have shown that. It's all these court-invented rules in the last, most of them in the last 50 years, to reduce the number of typical cases that are suing over business to business in the federal courts or because they don't like some law or whatever. They're being used to block this case, but this is a constitutional, unalienable rights issue we're bringing up here, and what the three words in the Constitution mean. And we certainly think we've presented a constitutional case or controversy. We're asking them to interpret the three words in the Constitution that have never been adjudicated before in the history of the country as it applies to the president.
Yes, and the courts have developed certain standards that go to this concept of case or controversy. You know, now, as we speak, in 2010, we're talking about injury in fact, for example. Okay, that's now part of this case or controversy.
That came out of the Lujan case, what, in 1982, Mario? That was presented. These rules are, that you're going to go over now come out of the Lujan case? Is that
yes,
the case?
Yes, yes. Justice Scalia, now he had written a law review earlier than that, like in the, 1980s or so, 82 or so. But then he got elected or appointed to the Supreme Court, and then he happened to write the majority opinion in Lujan. But that's, you know, one of the big cases that are used or is used today. And injury in fact, okay, I'm sure, you know, the people who've been following this are familiar with this injury in fact. And then you have to show causation that the defendant caused the damage to you that you're claiming or the injury, and then that the court can give you a remedy. Now, that sounds all easy, okay, when you talk about it, but when you apply it, and when the court is looking, I mean, they'll fine-tune it, and they'll slice it, and they'll slice it again.
Mm-hmm.
They keep peeling off these, you know, these layers, layers upon layers, you know, to get to a decision. So it gets very, very convoluted and very fact-sensitive, very fact-sensitive.
Those rules are very kind of easy to apply if money's involved or a physical injury or something like that. But when you're dealing with a constitutional issue, a core constitutional term, and somebody said one time that all words in the Constitution have meaning and you cannot ignore them, and the courts are not allowing us to get to the basic question and are hiding behind all these court-invented rules of standing to avoid addressing a constitutional question, and has never been addressed before in the history of the country, because nobody has been brazen enough as Obama to push the push it this far, and the media left him get away with it. They didn't vet him. Nobody vetted him. Congress didn't vet him. That's in our lawsuit. The lack of vetting that was revealed clearly in that Congressional Research Service memorandum that a volunteer obtained and gave to Mario, and we published on his blog on the 5th of November, shows conclusively that Congress knew that nobody vetted him. So we're here now, and the courts have been preventing vetting in the court system because of these court-invented rules of standing where they can take, based on those rules, they can take any case they want or turn away any case they want.
That's right. Now, when you think about injury in fact, okay, you got to have a concrete injury, and it's got to be particularized. Okay, now you can use those concepts to give standing or not to give it. And that's what Commander Kirshner is saying, Dr. Kate. That you know these concepts are so nebulous. Okay, I mean, what is a concrete injury? I mean, you can paint something to be concrete, or you can paint it not to be concrete. And then the minute you paint it, okay, and then you know the way you painted it, oh, that's not concrete. Or you could use different words and say, oh yeah, that's concrete. And the same thing particularized, okay? We're talking about four plaintiffs here. We have four plaintiffs, and we've shown how this applies to them. If this is their life, this is their happiness, their life, their liberty, their property. It goes to them.
My loss of due process, my loss of equal protection.
This is my
inalienable right under the Ninth Amendment to protect the Constitution, oath or no oath. I, as a citizen, have a right to support and defend the Constitution that is supposed to be protecting me. If I'm only just one person questioning that clause in the Constitution, the Constitution is supposed to protect me as one person, my individual rights are guaranteed and protected in that Constitution, not just the political majority at the whim of the moment. That's the beauty of our system. Even one person cannot be slighted or denied their rights under that Constitution.
Exactly. And we've had tremendous decisions in our judicial history because of one person. We've
mm-hmm.
had, equal protection.
Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yeah, right. I mean, one person, caused that. I mean, we have the endless examples of it where one person, Miranda, for example, is another
Miranda.
One in the criminal law. I mean, one person that comes out of the millions of Americans who comes forward and says, these are my rights. And then all of a sudden we create all this law and we change our society because of that, because of one person. But yet now, if we didn't like that case, we could have said, you're just like everybody else. You're just mm-hmm. like everybody else here. There's nothing special about you. You're injured like everybody else, so we're not even going to listen to that. So you can twist
maybe,
and turn this thing.
Maybe, Mario, you could go through the four questions that will help explain the violation of the rights that we're pointing to the Supreme Court. The four questions, the first one goes to the standing, but the other three go to the violations of the rights that we're pointing out. So I don't know if Dr. Case wants to read the questions one at a time, and then you can address them. I mean, that might be a reasonable way to approach what we are asking the Supreme Court to do.
In just a second, because I just want to pursue this just a little bit further, because You know, I've called generally the Obama attack a straw man, but I think what is being uncovered here is the arbitrariness in the standards for case or controversy.
Absolutely, Dr. Kate. I've learned in 22 months in pursuing this case, it's so nebulous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like they could say something's black as white as far as standing.
Right.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Right. So, like, for example, he was just going injury in fact, and then there's causation and remedy. And I know on causation they've tried to use all kinds of shields, which have failed. And then remedy, they've tried to also say you can't offer a remedy. So if you could briefly do that, and then... Yeah, let's get to.
But
the,
that's not true. We did offer them a remedy in
that's
in,
right.
In
that's
the,
what I. That's
in,
what
in
I'm
the,
saying. But I
in
want
the prayer for relief.
I want it
the remedy
relief.
Is
de- right.
The remedy is define what a natural born citizen is to constitutional standards as it applies to the president once and for all for the first time in the history of our country in our legal system. Get it defined.
Right.
We know what it means from history and the founders' intent, and then hand it to Congress and tell them to measure Obama against his yardstick, and if he meets it, he stays in. If he doesn't, he's out. The election is annulled.
Yeah. On the first item we spoke about, the first element, the injury in fact, and again, you got to show that the injury is concrete, that it's particular to you, and also that it's imminent or actually happening. Okay, it can't be something in the future, theoretical, that sort of thing. Then you move on to causation. And I think causation might seem to be easy to understand, but it gets complicated because you got to show that it's what's happening. The injury that you have is connected to what the defendant did. And then the remedy. The remedy also seems to be simple, but it gets very complicated. And the whole thing almost becomes circular when you start talking about the remedy because – then you get into questions of what power does the court have? You know, can it do something that orders the president? Okay, or how about if you didn't sue the right person? For example, what if we didn't sue Congress? Okay, and the court says, well, how can I give you a remedy? Because Congress is the one that has to investigate this, and they're not a party to this case, and you didn't sue them, so I can't give you a remedy because Obama's not going to investigate himself.
But
he didn't. You know, he's not going to do anything.
But we, just for the listeners, we did include Congress for that very reason.
yeah. We made sure that we had all the parties, you know, there so that we could get a remedy. Because again,
right.
we're putting forward the argument that the 20th Amendment, that Congress has an obligation, a constitutional obligation, to make sure that the president-elect is qualified. Okay, and that means with the president, it's three factors. He's 30. He or she is 35 years old. A resident of the United States for 14 years, and a natural born citizen. Those are three, which seem to be very easy items, okay? But sometimes they get a little complicated. So Congress has that obligation. So the remedy goes to what can the court do, you know? And that's always a fear factor for the court. So, you know, sometimes if they don't think that they can do something for you, you know, they don't want to end up with egg in their face that they issue an order. And then there's no enforcement, which has happened in our history. For example, with desegregation, okay, where the court, they ruled and governors said no, we're not doing it. And then the National Guard was called in to enforce what the court did. So that's remedy. Okay, now we have a great example with Andrew Jackson. I think it was in Florida, the land that belonged to. The Indians, and the court said, "Well, give them their land," and I think it was Jackson. He says, "Let me see you make me give them back the land," and basically he didn't give them the land.
Didn't Stalin say how many divisions does the Pope have one time?
Yeah, same thing.
That's the same concept. You can rule all you want, but you have to have a way of enforcing it.
Yes, so that's what we're talking about here, and the court is very sensitive to that because the court doesn't want to lose face, political face, or you don't want to lower the status of the institution, of that branch of government.
It shouldn't be that way. We should be a nation of laws and a rule of law, and they should be on a constitutional issue like this. They should be willing to take this case up and decide it because without the Constitution. if it's not enforced, the Constitution not enforced, this country's going to fall apart. We're a nation of immigrants, and the Constitution is the glue that's held us together. That is the common law, the foundational law of this country. And
yes, I agree with you, Charlie. I think that the court should err on the side of doing something with the risk that it won't be enforced, rather than not doing it because you don't want to lose face. You know, I think that you do more good for the nation and for the rule of law and for the Constitution to issue an opinion and just let it go into the society. Let it go. If it doesn't get enforced, mm-hmm. well, at least you've got something on the books and you've got people thinking about it and people learn from that.
Right.
You know, even though, now, I'm not asking for an advisory opinion, okay, because that's another problem with the Constitution. The court
and
can't give advisory opinions.
What you're saying, too, is the court should have allowed a question to be aired on the merits on this case, even if we didn't win it in the end. There should have been at least the question should have been addressed.
Yes. So that's very important for any legal system, regardless of who wins or who loses. Okay,
right.
Just like the World Series. You know, we have two teams mm-hmm. that play, and you know, once that game is over, okay, we have a winner. But then we say, okay, now you know, okay, next season, and mm-hmm. then we're going to have another World Series. Okay, so we don't get hung up on who won and who lost.
Yeah,
you know, but
the court
the
keeps
process
stifling.
Is what's important.
Right, the court keeps stifling the question from being even discussed in a legal forum where the rules are enforced as far as evidence and proof, and not just people getting away with showing things on the internet like an image of a so-called certification of live birth, and that's supposed to be evidence. That if they don't allow that, they're going to do what John F. Kennedy said that Dr. K quoted earlier, and I'll paraphrase it, that those who don't allow for a peaceful resolution may eventually enable a violent resolution.
The public's confidence also in the judicial branch, that's so important in a democracy. It's so important because, you know, the people are supposed to be free. Okay. Now, when I say democracy, let me correct myself. I've said this a million times. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When I use the word democracy, I mean where the people can have a part, have a say in their government.
Under the rule of law, though.
Yes, under the rule of law. That's where the republic comes
right.
in. Okay.
Right.
And again, you know, one person can make a difference in our country. That's a republic. Okay. You don't have that in a democracy. You know, democracy. I mean, you know, one lonely voice is lost. You know, the mass controls. What I'm saying is, I lost myself there. Lost my train of thought. But anyway, go ahead, Charlie. I lost my train of thought.
May I just ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah, just a little question. You know, you've made a very effective case, and apparently it's sort of a rule of the trade that if a judge does not address certain facts in a proceeding, that they basically are assuming they're true. How does this at all relate to purposely ignoring all the facts you've presented and also ignoring the significance of a constitutional question? Do we have a case before the Supreme Court that basically is saying, look, you guys didn't deal at all with any of this, so we presume it's true, so now we want the Supreme Court to finally make a decision? I don't know if that's even the right question,
well,
but there you go.
Well, what's before the Supreme Court
is four questions.
That's what's before them, just four questions.
Yeah, but I want to answer your question, Dr. Kate. You know, it's important that you said that because, you know, what happens is, yes, that rule exists that on a motion to dismiss for lack of standing, the court has to assume that what the plaintiff has pled in their pleadings, okay, in this case we have a complaint and a petition, okay, verified petition. We've pled many, many facts, okay. But the basic facts that we've pled that are important, just to summarize, is that we're saying that Obama has not conclusively proven that he was born in Hawaii, number one, and number two, that he hasn't conclusively proven that he's a natural-born citizen, and that he can't prove that because we know that there are certain facts not in dispute as to his father, you know, the non-citizenship of his father. So those facts are not in dispute. So we say, okay, the court has to assume those things to be true. And then, you know, the court can say, oh, yes, we're assuming those things to be true, but then it gives lip service to it. You know, it just says it just because it looks
right.
good by saying it, and you know it'll write it and say, oh yeah, we're assuming these facts to be true, okay? But then it just totally disregards them and goes ahead and does something else. But then nobody can criticize them because they said that, oh yeah, we're assuming these facts to be true. So that's so much for assuming the fact to be true, okay? So that answers. I hope that answers your question, Dr. Kate.
Like circular reasoning or catch-22 by the court. I don't know which one applies the closest, but they're assuming everything's true, but if they've assumed everything was true, they couldn't dismiss the case. They should take the case.
Yeah, right.
So, thank you. Yes, you did answer that question, and I think I've got an idea of, you know, how to break down the, quote, straw man article to really address these ways in which Obama has tried to attack your defense. So really, and this is why I say this is a test, because it's very much, if they have to accept those facts because of the rules, I mean, mm-hmm. they have to take the case. So that's what I would presume.
Well, let me just throw in,
I
could. Can I throw something in here?
Yes,
these federal judges are human beings, and they don't live in a vacuum. And they, I think, when they make their decisions, they're looking at the political winds. And when Obama was the Messiah walking on water in January of 2009, they saw the wind blowing strongly against them. And the media was 100% for Obama and against anybody who stood up. So given the fluidity of which way they can go with any given thing in front of them, I think they were bowing to political feelings and pressure, and didn't grant standing because of that. And even though they gave lip service to everything, you know, in the law that assuming the facts are true, they you don't have standing. I think we really did have standing. They just didn't want to grant it because of the political environment we were in. Now but our case is a legal question, and they shouldn't have done that. And maybe. Just maybe in the 22 months that have evolved, the political winds have shifted enough. And now that we're dealing with the Supreme Court, the most noble court in this country, not the lower courts, that we'll get a different answer. That's what I'm hoping and praying.
Well, if we shift over to that view for a second as well, what would you suspect about the impact, if any, of the CRS memo coming out? I mean, is the Supreme Court likely to have seen that, for example, having been leaked? And what do you think? If
I would like to hope so, but I don't know. I don't know what kind of pillow talk goes on.
The clerks
that roam the hall talk to the other clerks. That's the way it's done. In other words, a clerk sees it for Justice A, and he goes talks to a clerk for Justice B. You know what I mean? So, and then in the private conferences with their own respective justices, they're human beings. I'm sure the political environment enters into some of this, although it's not supposed to. It's supposed to be purely on the law. But if it was purely on the law and purely a legal question, we would have got this resolved at the first federal court that we got to, because the constitutional clause on natural-born citizenship has never been decided. The role of the federal body is to interpret the Constitution. That's one of their roles. It should have been addressed long before Obama even ran for office, in the primaries at least. They investigated McCain and not Obama. So,
exactly.
Now, the CRS memo is new evidence that, let's say, God forbid, we don't get our case taken up.
I wouldn't discuss that.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
So
yeah. That's why you're here, sir.
Let's
check me.
Into if it's appropriate in this discussion, let's segue into those four questions you presented. You know, last time we did do a pretty good discussion of those four questions, but Maybe if you could do that again, just briefly, the four questions presented, and also within there, talk about the reasons you also put forth why the Supreme Court has to hear this case. And I think that will tie up the whole piece, and then we can talk a little bit more about the other cases and so forth. How does that sound? Can you just go ahead and do that, and then
you want to read the questions one at a time, Dr. Kate, and then Mario can answer them?
Sure. Let me see. Of course, where's my copy?
These are in conference on Tuesday. These are the four questions that the Supreme Court justices are going to talk about privately in conference. There won't be no clerks there, no stenographers, just the justices. And we've asked two to recuse themselves, so ethically there should only be seven justices in that conference room.
Yeah, that's right. So they don't even, in a recusal, do they even get to see it?
No, they're not supposed to be involved at all. Again, we don't know what's happening with that. It's not that they told us whether they've decided yes or no. I'm assuming that they're going to make that decision when they're in conference. Of course they have to decide that before they start to talk about the case, because it doesn't make sense to ask somebody to recuse themselves. So right now we're just waiting to see what happens on that.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. Now, the first question is what I tried to address in my post today on standing in the Constitution. So if I've addressed it properly and we have talked about it now because I wanted to ask you questions, we can move on to the second.
Quickly read the first one so everybody who's listening knows what the first question was.
First question is whether petitioners sufficiently articulated a case or controversy against respondents, which gives them Article III standing to make their Fifth Amendment due process and equal protection claims against them. Do you have anything more to say about that we've not covered so far?
No, I think we've covered that, Dr. Kate.
Yeah, that's the
okay.
First question is the standing question. That's the whole battle of standing is wrapped up in that first question.
Yeah, and that's what we've been talking about. I thank you so much for helping us because it's still such a difficult concept to grasp. Okay,
so basically
second question
the first question, Article 3 says we have standing, but the court rules they've invented in the last 100 years say we don't, or they can allow us to say we don't.
And this is why the research on the Constitution has been essential to establish that our Constitution protects our individual rights, and therefore we do have standing. There you go.
Right.
So this is the brilliance of this research that's gone on and really the answer to that question of standing and why this case is so much about the Constitution. Second question is whether putative President Obama, thank you for not referring to him as, the president.
That's a legal expression that I use there. It's not pejorative. It's not to belittle him. It's not to, poke fun or nothing like that. But that's a legal choice of words.
Mm-hmm. Whether putative President Obama can be an Article II natural-born citizen if he was born in the United States to a United States citizen mother and a non-United States citizen British father, and under the British Nationality Act 1948, he was born a British citizen. This puts the question in a more not defensive way, but say, okay, he is born in the United States, but can he be a natural citizen?
If.
Go for it. I'll be quiet.
We don't concede that fact. Go for it, Mario.
Yeah, that's the famous meaning of natural-born citizen argument there. Again, those facts are not in dispute about his father and about his mother, about the British Nationality Act, about, Kenya, and that he's born a British subject. All those things are not in dispute. And then we say if he was born in the United States, okay? So for sake of argument, we're going to say that, okay, he's even assuming that he's born here. But that question leaves open that sub-question. And the sub-question is, was he indeed born in Hawaii, okay, which is a sub-question. Because when you write these questions for the Supreme Court, you don't have to write every sub-question of the question. If it's part of it logically, if it's within it, you can actually do a broad question, and then you can always argue the components in the merits, you know, later on if you get certiorari. So again, you know, I have not conceded that he was born in the United States, but so that again says, you know, can he be a natural born citizen, and that opens up those whole argument, which is very, very complex regarding the meaning of a natural born citizen. And I don't know how much you want to get into that, but just if I could say one thing.
I wanted to add that the Supreme Court likes to take cases historically that make history and that have never been adjudicated before. And this question, number two, is that type of question. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 has never been before adjudicated, and that's what's embodied in that question.
Yeah, and that is such a tremendous, tremendous study of our history, of our founding, of our Constitution. I mean, it's unbelievable what you go through when you study the meaning of a natural-born citizen. You go back, mm-hmm. 2,000 years, you know, to the beginning of civilization, and you move your way through it to try to understand what the founding fathers were thinking. Because really, that's really what you have to do here. You know, you have to get into their mindset at that time. And you know, when they wrote the Constitution, what was their intellectual mindset? What was influencing their ideas? You know, why did they want
natural law
was motivating them, and that was the justification for revolution. Okay, so you got to say now when they wrote the Constitution and they used certain words in there, okay, that's their intellectual makeup. So you got to go through this tremendous amount of history. And then when you do that, you really learn what our Constitution is and what it's designed to do and how it's designed to protect our happiness. Okay, because you know that word happy, you know, that sounds like sounds corny, right? But that word happiness, if you study our constitutional history, it's there. Okay, and
it's in the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness, and that comes out of natural law. Vattel codified it. He said pursuit of happiness is one of the prime directives of man. The pursuit of happiness. That's one of his natural rights.
Yeah, and it's unbelievable.
Exactly, and it is, and this also, for those who have not read all the materials that are available here, it really has been an astounding study, and there have been very weak arguments proposed against Vattel, for example, and so forth. But what I want to say about natural-born citizen and the term and its meaning, it still goes back to what we were talking about in standing in the first question. Because as a right, individuals, we had a right to set up the government, and we also had a right to define the characteristics of who the president was going to be. And that was for mm-hmm. our safety, according to the mindset back there, had to be a non-foreigner. And so the fundamental right that has been violated is, hey, those are our rights, that's the qualification. Government has failed to make sure that he's done that qualification.
For the office of the president and command of the military, they did not want any foreign, a person born with any foreign allegiances to devolve the power of the presidency. A person born with sole allegiance to
the standing issue. The standing issue threads through here on that question as well.
Yeah, and to put it in context, very important. You got to put it within a revolutionary context.
Right.
You got to do that because, see, now when Obama supported, they say, oh, it was the English common law. Okay, we're not talking about defining citizenship in a society that's ongoing, that's been going, you know, going. Okay, we're talking about a new society. Okay, it was a new society. It's not like an ongoing society, so there was no reason for them to continue the old natural born subject concept. Okay, they had a new concept. It was a natural born citizen, which is a whole different, coming out of the republic.
A subject could not become president. A subject could not become a president. These are citizens. A natural born citizen can become the president, but no natural born subject could ever be king.
Right. So the revolutionary context is so important, but yet when Obama supporters, they argue about what a natural-born citizen is, they don't even mention that, you know? They stay away from so many things, okay? But they don't address we're not talking about defining citizenship in a society that's ongoing, that it was a new society, new ideas. The founders rejected the English common law on the federal level, although the states used it, because they had to have a system of laws. It wasn't a state of nature. It was still a society that was moving, but it was a new layer.
I always say, Mario, intrastate municipal law, intrastate, they adopt a lot of English common law, but interstate for the new federal constitution, they look to unifying that universal concept of natural law because they were trying to unify 13 independent and sovereign states. They could not adopt the common law of one state or the common law of one country, like England or another country. They chose universal law, natural law, to unify the 13 free and independent states. That's what they looked to for their dividing of the federal constitution. Interstate law based on natural law.
And if you look at Article 3, that basically tells you what law was going to be applied on the federal level. And you've got the Constitution, you've got treaties, and you've got the laws of the United States. Okay, the laws of the United States. Now, what does that mean, the laws of the United States? It's not the common law, the English common law. Within the laws of the United States, you had the laws of nations, which, again, the law of nations, if you look at Article 1, it even talks about the law of nations. So clearly the founders are recognizing the law of nations as part of our law. Mm-hmm. That's part of our law. But yet you've got Obama supporters, they poke, you know, their little fun at us. Oh, you know, the law of nations. You know, like we're going to have some foreign law. First of all, it's not even foreign law.
It's not.
They make
the
it
law
look
of nation
like
comes from natural law. It's evolved from natural law. It's universal law.
Yeah, it's universal, immutable. The founders believed it came from God, or, you know, it came from nature. It was immutable and binding. That was the law of nations, and that's right in our Constitution, part of our law, which was basically it was incorporated into our common law, and you know it has its specific areas where it's applied. Okay, I mean it doesn't have the same force as our domestic law or our municipal law, whatever you want to call it, which handles all the many many things that go on every day between citizens and between companies and citizens and that sort of thing. But at that big philosophical level. Like, what is the society and who are its members? That's big. Those are big questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's where your natural law of nations comes into play. Not some municipal law or some local law.
Right. Municipal law is positive law. The law is broken down into two major subdivisions, natural law and positive law. Positive law is made by man. Natural law is created by the laws of nature and nature's God. They are immutable. You cannot change them.
Yeah, and whether people realize it or not, when you make positive law, okay, you're actually applying natural law. Well, see, what happens is it's your feeling inside you as to what's right and what's wrong, okay?
Right.
Why do we make a law and we say, oh, you can't do that? You know, why can't an adult violate a child? Why can't a man commit a rape against a woman? Why can't I go into the bank and rob the bank and take property? Okay, because as a society, when we go back into millennia, way back, okay. Now, putting aside the religious aspect, okay, because that's also a component there. But nature says, wait a minute. There's certain things that we're gonna, because of reason, we come to these decisions. We have a feeling of what's right and what's wrong. That comes out of natural. We use that word natural, and then we make laws. Then we make, like Charlie said, positive laws. But they're based on our feeling of what's right and what's wrong, morality, okay, coming out of nature.
So what's right and wrong as far as citizenship is we can say we're going to make you a citizen because we want to make you a part of the society and give you all the rights of the society. But only nature and natural facts at birth can make a natural-born citizen. Nature can make natural-born citizens. The law, the government can make citizens.
Yeah, here's another example that really brings the point home. We have corporations in our society, okay? We have limited liability companies, okay? Those are persons, like a trust, for example, okay, is a person, okay? The law makes those persons, but they're called persons. So we have a law that says, okay, that corporation exists, it's a person. It can do this, it can do that, a corporation can't vote, for example, okay? There's certain things that it can't do, but it's a person. Now, a law
can't have children.
A law cannot create a human being. It can't do that. You can't pass a law and then all of a sudden you create a human being. You can create a corporation, you cannot create a human being. So a human being is a natural person. It's a natural person, not a legal person. although he has, you know, rights that are based on law.
Same legal rights. Yeah.
Yeah, but when
process,
you come into existence,
due process, you, equal protection.
Yeah, when you come into existence, you come in as a natural person. Okay, and that's the same thing as a natural born citizen. There's no law that created that citizen. Okay, you didn't need, again, the corporation needs a law to be created. It's a person just like a human being. It can operate. It's a business, you know, so on and so forth. It could even donate money to a political campaign, right?
Yeah.
A corporation. But
and two,
so you get the point what I'm saying.
Two people can make another child, but it takes two citizens of a country to make a natural-born citizen of that country. So you have to be this, a natural-born citizen. Another way for genealogy is a second-generation American citizen by both parents. Both parents either were born here or natural-born or immigrated here, took the oath of allegiance, and got naturalized, and then a child is born to those citizens. That child is a children of the citizens. They are the natural-born citizens of the country, and 95% of the American citizens that are here are the natural born. They make up the culture of America. They are our culture. The natural born citizens are what America is, and the new people coming here, they can become part of that. They can become part of society and become a citizen by laws, by positive laws of naturalization, or they can get here by a constitutional, the 14th Amendment, by being born here, and they become a citizen. But to become a natural-born citizen, they can never be because they weren't created by the natural law of being born of two citizens.
The founding fathers were really interested in how the Indians operated in terms of society. They had their own society. Jefferson was, when he studied natural law, he thought about the Indians. He said, "Wait a minute, you know, here you have a people who have no laws." They had no written codes or anything. They just operated based on nature, okay? But, you know, they knew who they were. They knew this tribe was this person, and that tribe was this person, and this belongs to that one, and it was all done through the law of nature without writing anything down and not having courts and tribunals and all these, you know, fancy governments and things, okay? That was natural law, and Jefferson was really big on that. He observed how the Indians operated and how they were able to unify and get things done without actually having written laws.
We're talking about the American Indians, right, Mario?
Yeah, American
Indians. American
Indians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jefferson, right?
Well, so, we got Governor Jindal down there who wants to run for president someday, and he's the son of two Indians.
Well,
who
we had something
natural.
Else, but anyway, so
I'm just being divergent here. Mario got 30 pages in this petition to embellish and expand on these four questions, and he did spend quite a bit of time on what we just talked about on natural law in the petition, those 30 pages.
Yeah, very only 9,000 words you're allowed. So I couldn't get into all the information. You know, just a little bit of the natural law in the definition of a natural born citizen, because again, the main issue is standing. So that's got to be really, you know, brought home to the
right.
to the court.
All right, this has just been great. I learned so much from you. So, okay, we've established that, you know, we have standing. That was the first question, and it's been argued very, very effectively. The second question is what is a natural-born citizen and the need, and that, in fact, has already been defined and voluminous evidence presented on 30 pages in the brief is – in a writ or in a petition is just great because I know there are specifics that you have to do, but it's also, again, everyone should get a copy of this and read it. It's a history lesson. So having established those pieces, then question number three is whether putative President Obama and Congress violated petitioners' Fifth Amendment due process rights to life, liberty, safety, security, tranquility, and property, and Ninth Amendment rights by Congress, failing to assure them pursuant to the 20th Amendment that Obama qualified as an Article II natural-born citizen before confirming his electoral votes, and by Obama refusing to conclusively prove that he is a natural-born citizen.
Yeah. Basically, that says, look, Congress, look, President, you know, I have the right to be protected. I have a right to have my life, liberty, property, safety, security, tranquility. I have a right to be protected in that regard, okay? And making sure that the president is a natural-born citizen, that's part of that. because I have to trust that person. That person has to make the right decisions that affect my life, liberty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Now, if Congress is not willing to do that, is not willing to give you the protection. Now, remember when we started earlier in our discussion, both Charlie and I said, yeah, okay, you know, I'll give my allegiance to the government, but the government has to give me protection. See, that was the compact that was made in the Constitution. You know, we're going to create a government. I give you my allegiance. You give me protection. Now, if they're not keeping up to that bargain, then they violated
protection
my rights.
Protection for what? Protection of my rights. Not just protection from a bank robber or a guy breaking in my house, but protection of my unalienable rights, which they fought for in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, which are, you know, life, liberty, safety, security, tranquility, and property.
Pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, well, happiness is really the whole thing. I mean, you know, why? Although if we're dead, I mean, you know, we can't be happy or not happy. But you know, liberty and safety and all that, you know, it's really all for our happiness. All of that. That's really the end of government and the end of society is so that you can create the most happiness that you can. For the people,
and that's what Patel said the purpose of government was to provide happiness to the people, and the government shall always be perfecting itself to pursue more happiness for the people.
Exactly, and that number three there is saying, Congress, you didn't live up to your to the bargain. You didn't do it, and also you, Obama. You know, you're sitting in that office, and you don't show yourself to be a natural born citizen. So you're also violating my right to this protection. So that's what that's about. Number three. Dr. Kate. I guess there's a delay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry about that. Again, a delay. Okay, very good. So then the fourth is whether Congress violated petitioners' rights under the Fifth Amendment to equal protection of their life, liberty, safety, security, tranquility, and property by investigating and confirming the, quote, natural-born citizen, unquote, status of presidential candidate John McCain, not that of presidential candidate Barack Obama.
Okay, now, having understood number three, it's easy to understand number four. Because really what it means is this. Okay, the government, okay, which includes Congress and also the president, okay, they're supposed to give you this protection, okay? Now, the protection is supposed to be equal. In other words, don't protect that person more than you protect me because that person has a certain color, you know, on their skin or a certain religion or they're a male or a female or you know, sexual preference or because of their nationality or whatever, okay? So basically what it says is, you know, we're all supposed to be protected equally. That's the deal, okay? We all in this together, okay? Don't leave me out because you don't like the way I look or because I'm, you know, ugly or because I'm obese or whatever the case is or because you don't like my religion. We're all together. Treat me equally. So that says, why did you investigate McCain, okay? Why did you protect the people who were interested in that issue? They, in other words, people wanted to make sure he was a natural-born citizen. They wanted to protect
him. It was the same issue, but in that case, they were directing it at McCain.
Right, and they wanted protection, or else why would they even care? Why would they even care whether McCain is a okay, somebody might say, oh, well, that's political. Yeah, well, of course it's political, okay? But what is political? Isn't that, again, protection? You know, why do you – when you go and vote in the voting booth, why do you vote for one person and not another? Because you think that person that you vote for is going to protect you better, you know, and is going to get to that happiness that we're talking about. They're going to give you that happiness and that protection better than the other guy. Now, whether you do that on a party, you know, like, you know, straight Democrat or straight Republican or what have you, or you're independent, you kind of wait for every election. But that's what we're talking about here. So they protected those people who were
similarly situated. What they did was when citizens went to the Congress and asked about McCain, they investigated. Other citizens go to the Congress and say, investigate the natural-born citizens of Obama. They did nothing. The political majority did nothing to protect the rights of the minority who were questioning Obama.
Right, and which includes, of course, now, Commander, you want to tell us what, you know, how you wanted this protection. What did, you know, you took some certain steps here.
Yeah, I wrote letters to my elected representatives and senator in Pennsylvania and many, many other senators and representatives in key positions throughout the United States, and I didn't even get the courtesy of an answer. not even a form letter back. They just totally ignored people like me who were concerned about the constitutional eligibility of Barack Obama. Yet in April of 2008, they held standard hearings about the constitutional eligibility of John McCain when other people wrote about John McCain. But those people who were writing about John McCain happened to be in the political party that was in the majority.
And Obama supporters, they try to poo-poo what we're talking about. Basically, they look at it in terms of, oh, well, you know, you can ask Congress anything you want, but they don't have to answer you. There's no obligation that they have to answer you. You know, but this goes beyond that. We're not talking
That's
about
right.
asking them a question, okay, and they don't give you an answer, okay? We're talking about a big deal here. We're talking
about
a
constitutional right protection under the Constitution that is enforced.
Right, right, right. That's what we're asking for protection. We're not asking, you know, because we want to air a grievance of some sort, and they didn't answer us, and you know, and they laugh, you know, the Obama supporters, they laugh at us. They go, oh, poor, you know, poor birthers. You know, Congress didn't answer their question, and they think they can sue over that. You know, that sort of thing. Okay, but
and it seems to me, just, you know, from a layman's perspective, looking at the legal decisions that have come down. And, you know, standing in front of the Capitol with my signs in the usurpathon, people saying, oh, get over it. You know, you lost. That's it.
We lost our Constitution. We lost our Constitution. Get over it.
Right. And the courts basically saying, get a political remedy. Sorry. You know, this is not an issue. And this is how they've tried to diminish
it. So you can usurp the Constitution to the next election.
Mm-hmm.
So the Constitution is null and void for that part for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it falls flat on its face, and it just, what the word screams out to me is like cowardice that comes out, and so forth. So I would like to come up on a break and take about 5 minutes. We've got some callers, but I'd like you to, if you could, just briefly sum up this great discussion of the 4 points, starting with the standing, the definition of NBC, how the failure of Congress to protect those rights. You know, any closing thoughts on that, and then we'll move for a break and some questions.
Well, you know, it all blends together. Again, if I have a certain right and I'm injured, I need to have a remedy. Okay, that's in a system of, you know, the rule of law. We don't resort to violence. We resort to the legal process. And that's where the standing comes in. If I've been injured, there's got to be some place for me to go, which we call a court, that can give me a remedy. Okay, and here the rights that they're involved, again, it goes to the protection of the individual, which are my clients. We've talked about all that, so it's all connected together. And when the government protects the society, it does it equally. Okay, it doesn't give a favor to one over another, unless there's good reason for it. You know, sometimes it has to do that, okay? There's a reason for it, and the courts analyze what is the reason. You know, is it a rational reason, or is it, you know, there's different levels of scrutiny when it comes to equal protection. But anyway, so it's all connected together, and I just wanted to, you know.
When I feel the Constitution is there to protect me, or a person like me, and it's not protecting me because it promises me that only a natural-born citizen will be the president and commander of the military, And I petition my government for a remedy, and no remedy is provided, I have an inalienable right under the Ninth Amendment to go to my legal system and ask for that protection to be enforced, and that's being denied to me, and that's the question, one of the questions being presented here to the Supreme Court.
Very good. Thank you very much for that wonderful outline. We are going to take 5. I'm going to screen some calls, and we'll be right back. Commander and Attorney Apuzzo, if you wouldn't mind muting your own phones, take a break as well, and then we'll be right back. Thank you.
Radio. This is Dr. Kate on the line with our guests, Commander Charles Kirshner and Attorney Mario Puzo. Thank you very much for hanging in there. We have three callers on the line. First is Jack. Jack, I'm going to unmute you. There you go. Go ahead.
Okay.
Live mic, Jack.
Yeah, hi. I've called before. In fact, I talked to Dr. Kate a couple of years ago, back at the beginning of the Obama administration, in the context of the other cases that were going on. And I want to say, first of all, Commander Kirshner and Mr. Rapuzzo, you guys are great. I mean, to think that, I mean, people have so much to thank for what you're doing. And it's funny, I'm sitting here listening to this thing on the Internet, and whatever, I don't know how many people are listening, 20, 30 people. And to think that this is so important to the United States of America, this should be front page banner news. And the fact that it's kind of relegated to this where only a few people are listening, it's really, it's sad. It's like David versus Goliath. But what I wanted to ask you about specifically is, look, clearly, you know, you guys got the law. You explained the law. You got the law, and at least you got it. You passed the purple face test of on the merits, and certainly on standing. If they want to find it, they can find it. So the real thing here is really, really political. And if you can, it's like what I kind of want to know is what your feeling is in view of the fact that there now is a Republican Congress, and the courts would be under a different, not have the same pressures that they would at the beginning of the Obama administration, at which time, if they would have attempted to question his eligibility at that time, it would have caused riots in the streets. But where Obama stands politically now, it's almost to the point that if the court doesn't do anything and this question keeps getting raised louder and louder, there'll be riots in the streets the other way. And I guess what I'm looking at is what kind of plans or what kind of communications are going out to the court and elsewhere that if the court does not take this case, what that means, because basically it says that our judicial system has failed and it's people to take into the streets then. And if you could somehow discuss the politics of this thing,
well, let me,
what your feeling
let
is.
Me, let me answer your question, maybe, unless Tamara, you want to take it or you want me to take it.
Yeah, well, go ahead, Charlie, and then I'll just add something to it.
I think that we've given the legal system the best prepared case, the best argued case, the most judicially right case that's come up so far. If they pass on this one, the legal system has totally failed. We don't have a rule of law left in our country. And after that, we've done, Mario and I have done everything we can do in the legal system and the people who have supported us. After that, it's up to we the people. And all I will say, I will requote John F. Kennedy, those who make peaceful, paraphrasing, make peaceful resolution impossible, make violent resolution inevitable. And whatever comes after this, they caused it. The Obama progressives, doing what they did, caused it. They allowed the system that has worked for 234 years to fall apart. They have allowed the glue of our Constitution to be dissolved by ignoring it, by usurping it, by taking, in particular, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5, and saying it means nothing to us. Virtually, you know, you have congressmen saying you don't even have to be born in the USA to be the president. I mean, they're just so, let alone the other half, which is being of two American citizen parents. So it's beginning to be absurd what the progressives are doing. And we will have tried. And as far as what comes after, that's up to we the people. We're not going to hear tonight and say and predict, but it's up to we the people. And we cannot be intimidated by threats of violence from anybody. And the court system is acting under intimidation because they think a few people in the inner cities are going to riot. God, what's happened to us? What has happened to our country if intimidation and threats of violence are keeping this court from doing what is right? I don't believe that the vast majority of the innuendos of, oh, the blacks will riot, whatever, because he was, quote, the first black president. I don't believe the vast majority of American blacks would riot, because if it was ruled that the Constitution is being enforced and he's not constitutionally eligible, how can you riot against the Constitution? And certainly our oath keepers and takers and military would stand up to support the Constitution. So I can't believe that think it was more of the political winds that the court was reacting to, and they have changed. It's going to give them a little more cover to be more courageous. But we have never been to the Supreme Court before with a case this well prepared that was judicially right. The prior cases were either writs of mandamus to stop the election, and one other writ of certiorari was applied for, but they skipped the appeals court in that particular case. Maybe Mario can fill in more on that, but this is the first case that's really, really judicially ripe and properly prepared and presented all the way. No steps were skipped, and it wasn't filed too soon, and it wasn't filed too late.
Yeah, I'd like to add that when we talk about the political aspect here, we're really taking a risk by not having a natural-born citizen be the president. Now, what does that mean? That means that Mr. Obama, you know, he talked about change, and we've seen some of his change already. We've seen some of it. We don't know what's in store, what other change is in store, okay? Now,
yeah.
there's some big flags right now. Look at the health care. Look at the automotive industry, the banking. Okay.
Look at the lack of defense of our southern border. He does not want to put resources down to protect the sovereignty of our nation.
How he's approaching the internationally, how he's approaching that. Not protecting again, you know, on the immigration aspect.
He pulled the missile defense out of Poland with no compromise from Russia on the other side. He just pulled out the missiles arbitrarily.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we could talk a lot about the politics, but that's what's involved here by not having a natural born citizen, is that this person does certain things or does not do certain things, and you don't know where it could lead you. Okay, and that's in the future. So if the court doesn't do anything, that means that we still have this person as the president, and we don't know. No, he could just, you know, finish out these 2 years, not run again, or he could, you know, say, hey, I got 2 more years, then I'm going to run again, and just keep building and building and building a network, okay, planting roots, planting institutions of change. Okay,
Czars.
The change of what?
Czars.
Changing the American values. Changing, you know, if this individual has a certain mindset that America is evil, it is the product of conquest and of exploitation of other
not
people.
Not even if he's an evil Maru, but he's a citizen of the world. If he thinks that we shouldn't be a sovereign nation anymore and should just be part of this great world order that he wants to impose on us, that's not what America's about. That's not America's dream.
Yeah, so... so it's very, very risky as to what could happen. So, again, you know, so people many times think that we've arrived, okay? In other words, nothing else is going to change for the worse because we've experienced all the bad things already, okay? Well, the war has already happened and all this, you know, the plague already happened and all these different things. But society continues. The world continues. And anything can happen at any moment, even 9/11. Okay. Now, who would have thought that was a beautiful day? I remember that day. The sky was blue. It was a beautiful, clear day. And all of a sudden, we have this major catastrophe that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or think about an earthquake or a hurricane or you know, a tsunami destroying like half a country or something.
Look at creeping loss of liberty, though, Mario. Look at history. Those that do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Look at creeping loss of liberty in Italy and Germany. Look at where that led to. The National Socialist movements over there taking away individual liberties led us to a disaster, and 50 million people died over there because of it in the war.
Oh, and when you think about Hitler coming to power. Okay. Slowly,
yeah, Mussolini.
Slowly, right? He slowly gets to power, right. I'm sorry?
That's right.
Yes, you're right.
Slowly,
the liberties were taken away.
Right. And then look at the impact. Okay, so those are the risks that a society takes. And one person can be the catalyst of that. Again, you know, I mean, Hitler is a and I'm, you know, I'm not beating up on Hitler, you know, but I'm making a point. I'm making a point that one person can have a tremendous impact on what happens in the world. And that's the risk that you take here by not having a person there who's not qualified based on the founding fathers who went through a revolution. They experienced what allegiance was. They know the impact that allegiance can have on whether you win or whether you lose, whether you preserve your way of life or you become a slave to someone else. They personally experienced that. So that's the risk that we're looking at here.
Look at what Obama did when Honduran people wanted to protect their constitution. and they wanted to throw out a president who wanted to be stay president for life and wouldn't leave at the end of his term. The Constitution was enforced by the Supreme Court down there, and their Congress down there. And who did Obama side with? Hugo Chavez, Ortega, and Chavez from Venezuela against the Constitution of Honduras. He sided with dictators.
And not only
that,
the
kind of man we have it. He does not have allegiance to America solely at birth. He's a citizen of the world.
That's right.
He's a new world order guy.
Because we've got a couple of other callers coming in.
Okay.
One is he also used the word coup, which was improper in terms of what happened in Honduras. This is great. Jack, thanks very much for that question. We're going to move on to the next one. So the answer to really that question about what are you going to do when people say they're going to be riots is you really have
not,
to stand
not,
up
it's
this
not
way.
What we're
you know,
going to
do,
it's what we the
do.
People are going to do. It's what the people
That's
of a
right.
whole do.
That's
after
what
this.
I'm saying. We the people. That's what I'm saying is we the people are going to have to come back with the right response to that because you'd rather,
right.
you know, rather go down standing than, you know, sit down, go down sitting down. Okay, I'm going to bring in another caller now, 678 live mic. Hang on. The screen will let
Hello?
Me do this. There we go. There you go. Introduce
Hello?
Yourself and go ahead and ask your question. Yes. Are you there?
Yes. This is Michelle.
Okay, very good. Yes, go ahead.
I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I've really enjoyed the show. And I have a question about something that I believe Mr. Puzio said, and I may be taking this out of context, but I thought he said something about asking the nine justices to define what natural born means. So my question is, what source docs, maybe besides the Constitution, would those justices likely use to derive their definition of natural born?
Well, first of all, what we're actually asking them to do is to interpret the Constitution, okay, to look at it and tell us what a word means. So there's an approach that's taken when you do that. The first thing that they look at is the actual text of the Constitution, okay? So that's not like, you know, source documents. I mean, that's the Constitution itself, okay? So, they, you know, we ask them to read the words. What does it mean? Now, if the text itself cannot give you an answer, then you have to go outside the Constitution. That's, now, that leads into what you're saying there about source documents. Now, also what's interesting about when you look at the text, we have the Grandfather Clause itself, okay, which is, you know, the Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5. That has a certain text to it. But you also look to other parts of the Constitution, in other words, other texts in the Constitution.
Well, if I can interject, Mario, on that clause, though, a key point there is that clause identifies that there are two types of citizens, citizens of the United States and natural-born citizens.
Yes, which is part of the puzzle, part of the right.
Right.
Now, that's the text telling you that.
So that tells the justices that there's something different about natural-born citizens.
Yes, and that's why you start with the text, because that gives
right.
you clues. Wait a minute, what's going on here? How come we have a citizen of the United States, which, again, you know, you could be a citizen and be president, but after the adoption of the Constitution, you have to be a natural-born citizen. So then that presents a question that has to be addressed. Okay, but let's say you look at the Constitution and you look at it and you can't come up with an answer. Then you go outside it, and that's when you start to look at the purpose for the clause and history involved, inferences that you can draw from different sources. You look to precedent, you know, case law, the common understanding.
What books were they reading back then on legal matters? And
yes. That's the common understanding part, because, you know, if they're reading certain books and they're talking about certain things and newspapers are talking and they come up with a certain idea of things, that, you know, that becomes a common understanding, and the court looks to see again, that's called originalism, where you go back to the understanding there. Circumstances, change circumstances. Okay, that's also part of it. You know, has this thing changed over time? You know, do we still apply the same rule today, or has society evolved to a point where we have to give it a different meaning?
Prior case law, prior dicta and case law on the matter.
Yeah, that's precedent, okay? That's the precedent. Mm-hmm. So you have all these different factors, but the point is that you start with the text. That's what you start, and then you look to see what the intent was. Again, you look at history, you look at the culture of the time, you look at circumstances, anything that you could possibly look at. And there are cases that actually talk about this, and it tells you how to go about interpreting the Constitution. I hope that answers your question in a general way.
To answer her specifically, we included quotations from Vattel, the Law of Nations or Principles of Natural Law, and Mario cited various Supreme Court cases that touched on natural-born citizens, but not in relation to who can be president. That's never been adjudicated before.
Yes. There's if the court grants our petition, there's going to be a brief, a merits brief presented, and that's where you're going to see all this information come out, in the merits brief. Okay, the petition that I submitted, that doesn't have all the information on a natural-born citizen. Okay, that's just a brief argument.
But it has
using
some.
Vattel.
Yep. You had Vattel
scored
in there.
It's a brief argument just to make the issue and argue it somewhat, because, again, within the limit of a petition, which is only 9,000 words. But all those sources that Commander Kircher is talking about, case law and founders and people like David Ramsey, for example, and Jefferson,
right.
and natural
and
law.
And quote on what Happer said, Minor versus Happer said. For a Constitution, you have to look to sources outside the Constitution, right? Isn't that case that he said that? Or?
Well, Minor versus Happersett says that you look to the common law, and you know what's interesting is that the common law that the court looked at was not the English common law; it was the law of nations.
And then he went on to say. Without any doubt, what is a natural-born citizen?
Yeah,
there's
no doubt what a natural-born citizen is. Again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about in nature. You know, if you think about the American Indians, they didn't have any rule, anything written down or anything when a child was born in the tribe.
But in that case, they
everybody knew that he was part of that tribe.
In that case of Minor versus Happersett, he said, without a doubt, a person born in a country of two American citizens is a natural-born citizen.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, just like there's no doubt in nature. You know, an Indian was born in the tribe, and everybody knew he was a Cherokee, he's a Iroquois, he's whatever, you know. So that's the idea. But anyway, we have not gotten into all the different source documents that you're asking about. Again, that would be in the merits brief. All the legal sources.
The key point of
her
question, though, is that that's why we need a trial. That's why we need a hearing. We need to air this so that the justices can decide this for the future of our country. Because if they don't decide this, this is going to happen again. And Mario
said in his brief for this petition,
he says that this must be decided not just for Obama, but for the future of our country.
Especially in the context of immigration and illegal immigration that we have going on. Very good.
Anchor
Thank
babies.
You. Exactly. So there more later on that, caller. Thank you very much. We have another caller, Area 215, Ron, with a technical question, I believe. Okay, Ron, live mic.
Yes, hi. A little nervous here. My name's Ron from Pennsylvania, Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And
hey, your neighbor, Ron. I'm in Pennsylvania.
Hey, how about that? Yeah, I know you are, Commander. I've been following this this whole thing, and I'm just sitting here thinking about November 23rd. It's like holding on to a lottery ticket, and you just waiting for the day for them to call the numbers for the lottery ticket, and hoping that you win. And
that we still retain our liberty, Ron. We still want to keep our liberty, right?
That's true. The prize I think is like $13 trillion at this point. But anyway, I had a question, and the two callers and your explanation kind of answered a lot of my questions. But I just had something I wanted to throw out at you. As far as the natural born, let's say that you had a U.S. citizen, and then you had, let's say, a woman that had a green card. And with the green card, you can live in the United States. Am I right?
Well, you can't be a citizen and have either you're a citizen or you have a green card.
And if you have a green card, you still have allegiance to your mother country. See, that's the problem with allegiance. Natural-born citizen has to have sole allegiance at birth, and you get that allegiance via both parents and the soil you're born on. It's three different ways you can get it. Now, the child of a mother who had allegiance to a foreign country, under current laws, he inherits allegiance for the foreign country through his mother.
Right.
And if there's a divorce there,
but we need a question.
What I was getting at is, okay, so you have a male that's a U.S. citizen, you have a female that has a green card, and they get married. I mean, I'm presuming they're allowed to get married. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right.
In the United States. Okay.
Right.
Then they have a child. Then they have a child. Now, the child, is he a natural-born citizen, or is he a natural-born citizen?
Well, let me ask you,
Ron,
in 1787, he would have been, because as soon as they married, she would have got citizenship from the husband, all right? That's called derivative citizenship. But under current law, no. She has independent citizenship all of her own, right, Mario?
Yeah, well, the proper question that you have to ask, we're talking about the case against Obama. The mother was a U.S. citizen,
right?
And the father is not even a green card. Okay, so that's really what we have to analyze here.
Right.
Yeah, he was a sojourner. He didn't even have a green card.
The mother is a U.S. citizen, and the father is not even a citizen. So that's really what
not even a permanent resident.
Yeah, he's not even a resident. He doesn't even have a green card.
Okay, but
so that's the issue.
He's being hypothetical, Mario. That if you had a non-citizen mother and a citizen father, would he be a natural born citizen? No.
The child would be
born with dual nationalities.
This is for future cases, but let's say when they got married, the woman applied for citizenship, and then they had the child. Or, you know what I'm saying? In other words,
under natural law, no. But you're just drawing lines in the sand and saying, well, how far over do you want to go on this? You know, these are issues that the Supreme Court's going to have to address.
You know, let's put it this way, okay? It's tough enough to deal with a clear case
right.
of Obama's father not being a citizen, and we've been arguing at this thing about for 2 years now, and then when you're going to start, you know, keep you know,
hypotheticals,
peeling these layers and hypotheticals, you know, it gets very very complex. You know how soon is, you know, is there a window of opportunity? You know, is there an intent on the part of this woman? Okay.
Right.
I mean, you know,
if she applied for naturalization but hadn't taken her oath yet, you know what I mean? You can just keep drawing lines.
Yeah, you've got all kinds of situations, but here with Obama, we have a clear-cut situation where the father is not a citizen and doesn't intend to be a citizen. You know,
in fact,
he
was militantly against this country. He didn't like this country. He had no allegiance to this country. He had no affinity to this country whatsoever.
Yeah. So you know, it's not that complicated of a case. It's easy in terms of that he had no intent to ever be an American citizen. He never became an American citizen. He was never a legal resident, a green card holder. Okay. So you know, and it's an easier case, and we can't agree on it, you know. So you could imagine when you get into something more complex, as what you're describing there, Ron.
I'm hoping, Ron. It's Ron, right?
Sure.
I hear you. Hello.
I'm hoping that the Supreme Court defines natural born citizen for Article II purposes definitively, so that we don't have to go peeling the onion in the future.
Yeah, and that onion's got a lot of layers.
Yeah.
Caller 803, live mic.
Hi, Charlie. This is Just One People. And I'm on Facebook right now. And there is a person
on
here.
Could you say who you were again? Since you call me
Just
Charlie,
One People?
Do I know you?
Yeah,
Just
you know
people.
Me.
Okay.
Just One People,
hey,
you know me?
From email, yes.
Yeah. Just now on Facebook, there is a poster that has been making posts by somebody he knows in the White House. And he put a post up tonight asking, what's the thing about certification? I don't understand. And it has blown up, and there's been at least 15 people that have come on this thread.
Certification
that have said
of
they
what?
Don't, well, that was what it started out as, is certification of what? That he was eligible to be that he was eligible to be put on the ballots, or the birth certificate thing, or whatever. But all of your stuff is getting posted on Facebook right now. There are at least 15 people that are on this thread on Facebook that have never heard of it. And I am sending them over to Mario's website to read up and find out what they're talking about.
Well, great. Do you have a question for us tonight?
No, I just wanted you to know that you've got a whole bunch of people interested that didn't know anything about it, that now know that this week or next week it will be going to the Supreme Court.
Very good.
And I thought you'd
very
like to know
caller.
That.
Thank you very much, caller.
Thank you for all you're doing. God bless you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Very good. We have one more caller here, and then I have a couple of questions from the chat room. Area 215, live mic.
Hi, Dr. Kate. It's Patty Dunn. I just wanted to get in there, and I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you, Dr. Kate, for your beautiful, eloquent, brilliant post day after day after day after day. The courage that you show, the spirit that you have. I don't even know. I'm gonna move on. You already know I love you. I want to say Lieutenant Commander Terry Lakin, what a gentleman, what a hero, what a man. Defend our defenders, please. Everybody, come to the aid of your country. Please, please, please check out Terry Lakin today, facing court-martial on December 14, 2010. Commander Kirchner, thank you. Thank you, thank you, every single day. Mario Pizzo,
can I interject?
Attorney
can
Pizzo.
I interject before you before you
yes,
go
yes,
on
sir.
Be passed with Lieutenant
yes.
Colonel Lakin? I want to point out that we put a judicial notice in our petition to the Supreme Court. Mario did this, calling
I know
specific
you did.
Judicial notice to Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's court-martial and Lieutenant General's affidavit querying about the extreme damage to the chain of command that could be done.
So that issue is before the Supreme Court. They're aware of it through the petition.
In
right.
writing.
We took the opportunity to bring that case in.
Eloquently, in writing, perfectly stated that you had had the tenacity and the beauty of just being a hero of going in there and putting that statement in there because maybe, just
well,
maybe.
You can thank Mario for that. That was Mario's idea.
Thank you, Mario. I mean, Attorney Apuzzo. Thank you so much. Because maybe, just maybe, we will have a stay. What you have presented that is perfect in every single way. We have to thank you so much for bringing this to the attention of everyone because
we get our petition heard by the Supreme Court. His defense counsel could immediately then apply for a stay and say, while the Kirchner case is being decided, we ask for a stay. Correct, Mario?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks,
Patty. Yes, well, he could do that because,
sure.
Again, you know.
That's up to his lawyers. That's up to his lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, of course he should do that because, you know, if there's a question about the eligibility of the commander-in-chief.
Yeah, if the Kirchner case is going before the Supreme Court, his case should be stayed until the question is decided.
Yeah, the whole court-martial has to come from the chain of command. I mean, the whole process.
That's right.
You know, how
right.
could you have a court-martial if you don't have a, you know,
legitimate
the link
president.
To the commander-in-chief?
You have a in particular, now, people in the military know this. Orders to be deployed overseas come from the president directly to deploy units overseas. So in this particular case, there's no question the order to deploy his unit overseas was issued by and signed off by the president. So if we have an illegal president, Lieutenant Colonel Lakin has every right to question the eligibility. That's that Nuremberg issue. I mean, if the president is not eligible, what's he doing ordering soldiers into the field of battle where they can be charged with war crimes for fighting an illegal war ordered by the president, who's not legal?
Yeah, and again, even on the aspects of a court-martial, in a constitutional republic, everything has a flow. It comes from the top, it goes
mm-hmm.
down, but it's all linked together through rule of law. And
right.
you've got a process going there, and you don't have the proper head in place. Well, then that's the process is tainted. You know, the court-martial is tainted.
Under the UCMJ, the authority of the court-martial emanates from the president himself. So if you don't have a legal president, that court is not even legal.
Exactly.
Try him.
So this, again, reinforces how much this entire case is about the Constitution.
Exactly.
And, you know, the rule of law. And, Patty, I want to thank you very much for coming on. I've got a couple more questions. We have about 5 minutes left, so I'll be coming back around to our callers if they still want to talk. But here's the question. Don't know if you can answer it, but what about Gary Crete's involvement in the case?
Well, I'll just touch upon it briefly. Basically, he has filed on behalf of the Western Center for Journalism an amicus brief. An amicus brief basically is a friend of the court brief. He supports our petition for a writ of certiorari. We're very happy to have the Western Center for Journalism take part in this because we wouldn't be in this mess if we had the proper journalism. Okay, I think that there's something going on in our country where journalism has become such a biased thing. We're not getting news anymore; we're getting political opinions slanting. Even the way this case is reported, the Kirchner case. I mean, what major news outlet, television station or radio station or whatever, mainstream media, quote unquote, have they reported on this? Are they talking about it? No, they're not,
And they know about it because we have a full-page ad running in the Washington Times National Weekly declaring this case is before SCOTUS.
Yeah, so journalism is very, very important in our country. It could actually, I think, and you hit this very, very well, Dr. Kate, in your article. You wrote about the failure of journalism could actually be the failure of our society, of our way of life. Because it's not giving us the proper information. So, we're happy to have the Western Center for Journalism take part in the case. And I just wanted to say one thing. There was confusion, not on our part, not on the Kirchner part or the plaintiffs or my part, about whether or not this amicus brief was being consented to. Clearly, we consent to the brief, and we never denied our consent to the brief. We never did. So I just want to say that for publicly, because there was confusion about that. And so again, we welcome it. And I guess Commander Kirchner, you want to say something about it?
No, I think you summed it up very well.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. We have one more comment question from Patty regarding precedent. So, but we only have 2 minutes left, so very quick, and then we'll call for closing comments. Go ahead, Patty, on live.
Commander Kirchner, Attorney Abuso, please speak to precedent forever, for all times, for the United States of America? What does this mean for us today? What does it mean for us tomorrow? Precedent. Can Osama bin Laden's child, who was born in New York City by, you know, some Mexican woman, be president?
The way the supporters of Obama, the way they argue the Constitution, the answer is yes to your question. You could have Osama bin Laden's child be born, you know, he with another woman, okay, who come from some country, who knows where, they just happen to come over here, and they could have a child born on American soil, and according to Obama supporters, they say that that child is eligible to be the president, okay? Now, I said eligible. Now, of course, the people have to make a decision, okay, whether they want this child to be president, but you know, it's not that easy. You know, you think that the people know what's going on, but then you run into the problem of what we just talked about, journalism. Okay, you know, is the press going to inform the people, or is this person going to hide themselves like Obama did? Okay, hide all their records, and now you can't vet him. And now because of he's got a certain religion or a certain color, you know, people think, oh, we got to be politically correct. We can't ask too many questions. You know, so there's the danger, and the founding fathers saw the danger. That's why they have the Electoral College, which today is meaningless because they're like obligated
They've emasculated that Electoral College because state laws now require them to vote with the way the people vote.
Yeah, so it's very dangerous, you know, to just to have a person be able to run there because, again, you know, can we trust
without the press vetting the candidates, we are at the mercy of the political parties.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Everybody,
sorry,
say
didn't mean to make it there.
Everybody, say
thanks
a prayer that the Texans will do the right thing on Tuesday.
Thank you, Dr.
For joining
Kate.
Us. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you for having us on. God bless.
Thanks.
Bye.
Good night.
Get up. I say, Father, I need my